Hello, and welcome to the AMA's Steps Forward podcast series. We'll hear from healthcare leaders nationwide about real-world solutions to the challenges that practices are confronting today. Solutions that help put the joy back into medicine. AMA's Steps Forward program is open access and free to all at stepsforward.org.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. This is Dr. Jill Jin, Senior Physician Advisor at the AMA, and I am your host for today. For today's episode, I am joined by Dr. Janine Engel, Associate Professor in the Division of General Geriatric Palliative and Hospital Medicine at the University of Virginia School of Medicine, Associate Chair for Quality and Patient Safety for the Department of Medicine, CPT Advisor for the American College of Physicians, and one of my co-authors on the AMA Steps Forward Toolkit on Simplified Outpatient Documentation and Coding, which will be the topic of today's discussion. So welcome, and thank you for joining me, Dr. Engel. But before we dive into all things coding, can you tell the listeners a little bit more about yourself, your background, anything that you want to say in particular about why and how you got into the world of E&M coding and billing?
Certainly. I started out in primary care more years ago than I'd like to care to admit, but back in the late 1990s and early 2000s, as some of the new coding guidelines sort of hit the books, our group at Vanderbilt sort of didn't really understand what we were doing. And I took it upon myself with some coaxing from a colleague to kind of learn the new guidelines in around 2000 and then present that to my colleagues there in primary care. And it was really eye-opening for us to hear it from another physician who could apply it to kind of the work that we were doing within our clinic and our primary care, you know, day-to-day work. And it really affected our billing and our both our RVUs and our income as we found that we were really consistently undercoding at the time. I realized then that there really weren't a lot of physicians doing this work, meaning learning it and teaching it on a peer level. And that really opened a lot of doors for me around the ability to connect my skills and in the educational realm. So I continued to develop this over time, and it led to a number of other opportunities, including some work with the American College of Physicians and joining the work there with some of their committees, as well as becoming their advisor to the CPT editorial panel. So I've done that for more than a decade. In addition, I've given coding talks around the country. I've been involved in some of the development work with some of the changes in both the valuation of E&M codes, as well as advising on some of the changes in the definitions, including the newest code changes and redefining of things like medical decision making. So it's been really exciting and, you know, fun to have those opportunities over the years.
Wonderful. Yes, thank you for doing all this work as a practicing physician to help advocate for ease in billing and coding for other physicians. Okay, so I want to talk about two main issues that are covered in this toolkit. The first is note bloat, and the second is accurate coding, as in not undercoding or overcoding, but I think, as you mentioned, more so undercoding, because I think a lot of physicians in practice are kind of by default still undercoding a bit. But first, let's talk about note bloat. For an outpatient visit, what should and shouldn't we be putting into our notes? And specifically, you mentioned the latest E&M guidelines. They were updated in 2021. Tell us what's new in those guidelines.
So I think far and away, the most important things that have changed in the newest E&M guidelines was the emphasis on medical decision-making as really the core of choosing the levels of service, with the elimination of specific history and physical exam elements that were needed for the various levels of service. I think none of us who've been doing this for a long time were sad to see things like the review of systems requirements dropped and really allowing us as clinicians to make decisions about what was medically necessary or clinically appropriate to go into our notes for any specific clinical encounter. And so now we can document, you know, an appropriate history for the patient or the encounter on a specific date of service. We can also add any past family or social history that may be relevant for the patient that day without worrying about, did we get the needed elements to bill at a certain level? And then what really matters and what is important both for really communication as well as for the complexity of the visit is the medical decision making. And so this allows us to really put in, I believe, the important elements of the visit that day without having to re-document some of the things that may not be as important for both us to read or for someone else reading our notes to go into. So that would be things like all of the patient's past family and social history or a complex review of systems that might not really be necessary for the patient that day. In addition, things like the data section, you know, if it's helpful to add in the specific data into the note, I think that's fine personally, but it's not necessary from a perspective of making decisions about billing. And we can, that can really, I think, help in terms of the length of notes or getting to what's really important. And the way I like to sort of summarize this is to say, you know, think about when you read a note on a patient you haven't seen before, or even on one of your own patients from a specialist, do you really read all of the middle section? I mean, I tend to read the HPI part, and then I scroll down to the assessment and plan. And I almost never read the stuff in the middle unless I'm interested in maybe a specific physical exam finding or something like that. And so I think in many ways, the new documentation guidelines sort of followed that in terms of saying these other things may be clinically relevant, and if they are, include them. But if they're not, if it's not clinically relevant, it's really okay to leave those things out of your day-to-day documentation.
Right. So in terms of the note template, if you haven't updated them yet, it's probably time, right? Take out the review systems, take out the past medical, family, social history. You don't need to automatically pull all that in, right? It should be whatever is relevant and getting straight to the assessment and plan. And then actually what I started doing is I even for the HPI part, I just say see assessment plan and put the HPI, the relevant parts in the assessment plan itself.
Yeah. So, you know, I have recently done something really similar, which is to start using problem-based notes where I have the ability in the EMR that we use, which is the same one that lots of other institutions use because I'm at an academic facility, where I can have an overview section for each of my patient's chronic problems. And then I can add the assessment or the current assessment for the day that I'm seeing them. And that allows me to have that overview, which is really a chronology of the patient's long-term back history of that particular problem there. And I can choose to insert that into my note or not based on sort of the circumstances. And so I could just have today's assessment and plan, or I can have both the overview and the assessment and plan. But having that overview there allows me to look at it, and anyone else reviewing the chart can also see that information if they wish to.
Right, exactly. And we do have some specific vignettes up on the toolkit about with actual examples of progress notes, of, you know, full length progress notes, but they're actually only a dozen lines long because that's all that needs to be there in terms of the text. So encourage you, and we'll link it to this episode, but encourage you to take a look at some of those vignettes on our toolkit. So let's shift gears now to talk about coding and specifically the different levels of service for problem-focused visits. So we're not talking about preventive visits, you know, the so-called annual exam or routine checkups, but rather problem-focused E&M visits, which can either address acute problems or follow-up of chronic problems. But the question is, of course, what makes a problem-focused visit a level 3 versus 4 versus 5? Now, I know CPT has a whole big table about this, and it just, I think many people's eyes just glaze over when they look at it. So can you break it down for us?
Yeah, I think I can. So I think the things to really concentrate on here are the presenting problems and the risk. And certainly data comes into play here, but really data, I think, only comes into play when you're evaluating or end up looking at a really a lot of data. So I'd like to concentrate first on different types of problems that tend to come into clinics and then we'll talk a little bit about risk. So, you know, a level three problem is are in the category of low. And so low problems are going to be things like one stable chronic illness or one acute uncomplicated illness. And so if you're seeing a patient for follow-up of just one stable chronic illness, say it's hypertension or diabetes, and that's really all that you're managing that day and there's nothing else, then there's a good chance that that's going to end up being a level three, unless you end up having a whole lot of data or they end up in the moderate risk. Because you remember, it's two out of three, meaning problems, data, and risk that get you to a certain level. But if you start out with a low-level problem, then the likelihood is you're going to end up probably at a level three. And so a lot of your maybe urgent care visits, like a URI that's viral and that you're going to tell patients to use over-the-counter meds, and again, you're not managing anything else that day. You're not considering any of their chronic illnesses that might be interplaying with that. Those are going to be kind of your level three type problems. I did urgent care for a while at one point in my career. And, you know, I built level threes for a number of the patients that I saw, particularly if my treatment regimen was over-the-counter, go home, you're fine, reassurance, that kind of stuff. So that's kind of the level three realm. However, if you start with a series of presenting problems that get you into the moderate, the level four, then you have the possibility then of building a level four. And the problems in the moderate stage are one or more chronic illness with an exacerbation, side effect of treatment or progression. But the important thing to know is that a chronic illness with exacerbation, progression, or side effect, the definition here is basically, if it's not a stable chronic illness, it's the other thing. So if it's uncontrolled diabetes or hypertension that's not controlled, meaning you're adjusting the meds or you're doing some type of intervention, that makes it a chronic illness with exacerbation, progression, or side effect of treatment. I almost wish they had called it uncontrolled chronic illness, because I think that's sort of how we refer to it. The other thing that gets you to moderate in terms of problems is two or more stable chronic illnesses. That's a whole lot of what we do in primary care, right? So here, if you have two chronic illnesses, even if they're stable, that gets you to level four in terms of problems. That's the big difference between three and four. Is kind of where you're starting with what problems are you addressing during the visit. And again, it's not just they have it. You have to be addressing it or managing it or doing something with it. So it's not just that it's on their problem list. It's something that you have to be doing something with that day. Even if your decision is it's stable, we're continuing the same meds, you have to at least address it in some way.
What you mentioned, which were kind of two key points in my mind, is that this two stable chronic illnesses that we're thinking about in some capacity is almost all of our primary care patients, right? Because I really can't think of the last patient I saw with only one stable chronic illness, right? So I think that is a key point. And I think that's new, right? In 2020, with the 2021 guidelines, before it was three stable chronic illnesses and they decreased that to two. Is that right?
That is true, because the old system under the points, you needed 3 points to get up to moderate. And so, and I think a stable chronic illness was only 1 point. It's been so many years since I had to use points, it's hard for me to remember. But I think you are correct about that, that it went down to two in this case. And I do think that's a super important point about, you know, patients are, you may feel like you're only managing one problem, but often you're thinking about several other things that are impacting it, and you just need to remember to list it as a problem, like social determinants of health. Like, that is a problem. And so their housing insecurity or their difficulty getting medications because of costs, like these are actually, I would list this as a separate problem, because it is one. And it negatively impacts your ability to care for them and their ability to get to access and manage their other medical problems.
Yes, exactly. And that was the second key point I was going to mention regarding the social determinants of health. Absolutely agree. It should be treated as a separate problem, not only because it gets you to that extra quote-unquote diagnosis, but also, and I know we'll talk about this a little bit later when we get to risk, but also it's something that elevates risk to a level 4 as well.
And on an important but sort of alternate side note, in 2024, on the hospital side, it will be mandatory reporting for CMS to report some type of social determinants of health for our hospitalized patients. And I think the writing's on the wall that this is something that will be coming on the outpatient side as well. And so it behooves us to get in the habit of knowing this about our patients and documenting this.
Can you, and I think we have this in the toolkit, but can you give an example of how you would document SDOH? What would you write in your note for SDOH?
Yeah. And so we have, like so many of us with EMRs, like we have a dot phrase, you know, so all I have to know is .SDOH, and it's actually embedded in our clinic, in our main clinic template. But essentially, it's something that says, you know, this patient's visit today has been negatively impacted by social determinants of health. And then there is a pull down that allows us to choose which aspects of those social determinants are impacted. And so we have the option of clicking whether it is housing or financial or other things that are impacting their ability to get adequate health care.
One more thing I wanted to address regarding those level 4 problems, those level 4 diagnoses that has confused clinicians and coders alike, because we've gotten a lot of queries about it since publishing our toolkit, is this whole concept of systemic symptoms. So in the CPT definition, they call a level 4 problem an acute illness with systemic symptoms. And the definition is an illness that causes systemic symptoms and has a high risk of morbidity without treatment. It goes on to say for systemic general symptoms, such as fever, body aches, or fatigue in a minor illness that may be treated to alleviate symptoms, see the definitions for self-limited or minor problem or acute uncomplicated illness or injury. Systemic symptoms may not be general, but may be single system. Okay, so I think so many people are confused by reading this because they're interpreting it to mean that fever, body aches, fatigue do not count as systemic symptoms. But I don't actually think, and I know we've talked about this, that that's what they're saying. So could you explain what your interpretation of the statement is?
Absolutely, yeah. And I should have talked about this, but I think it's a separate issue of sort of above and beyond, like what's a level 4. So included as among the list of presenting problems that can be a moderate level problem is this one acute illness with systemic symptoms. And I think that this particular definition is worded a little bit awkwardly, which is why it kind of gives a challenge as you read it. But I think the most important sentence is the first sentence, which is the definition. It's that it is an illness that causes systemic symptoms and has a high risk of morbidity without treatment. And that's really the most important thing. So an acute illness that has systemic symptoms, and if you don't treat it, you have the potential for morbidity. So I can think of lots of things that might follow this. You might have abdominal pain with fever, right? And you don't know what that is, and you have to evaluate that. And there could be a morbidity if you don't treat it, because maybe it's appendicitis, maybe it's an acute bacterial, you know, gastroenteritis. Like, it could be so many things. The second sentence in that definition is just giving information. It's not related to the definition. It says for systemic general symptoms such as fever, body aches, or fatigue, in a minor illness that may be treated to alleviate those symptoms, go look at these other definitions. So they're just giving information because I think the folks that wrote all these definitions didn't want those of us reading these or coders or others to think that if you have a general symptom, that makes it an acute illness with a systemic symptom. In order for it to be an acute illness with systemic symptoms, you have to have both the systemic symptoms and a high risk of morbidity without treatment. Both of those things have to be true. Mm-hmm. Whereas these others, the self-limit or minor problem, is things like a URI. You might have a systemic symptom like fever, but you don't have the high morbidity without treatment. Because these other types of illness definitions have things like they run a regular course and they improve without intervention. The second sentence is informational. It's not part of the definition of that acute illness with systemic symptoms. And that final sentence around that systemic symptoms could be both general or single system, what they mean there is that you could have like an abdominal acute illness where the systemic symptom could be like nausea and vomiting. And so they're saying that systemic symptoms could be symptoms that we would relate to a single organ system, as opposed to being what we call those general symptoms, which are, you know, like the general ROS, fever, night sweats, weight loss, et cetera.
Yes. So in other words, fever, body aches, and fatigue do count as systemic symptoms, which is what we all learned in medical school, but they in itself would not elevate an underlying uncomplicated illness to a level four. So if you had an uncomplicated minor illness with fever, it would still be level three if there was no significant risk of morbidity without treatment.
Correct, yes.
But then if you did have a complex acute illness with a high risk of morbidity without treatment with fever, then fever, of course, does count as a systemic symptom in that situation.
Definitely.
Excellent, thank you. So let's move on to risk and that component of the medical decision making. Can you first sort of define what risk refers to in this context, and then provide a description of what makes a level three versus level four risk?
Of course. So definition of risk changed a little bit in 2021 with the new CPT definitions. And risk now is specifically defined as the risk of complications and or morbidity or mortality of the patient management decisions made at the time of the visit. There's, again, the four levels of risk, but really the important thing is to kind of understand what gets you low risk, what's moderate, and then what might meet high risk. And so, you know, low risk, they don't really give any specific examples there, but there are some specific examples around what gets you to moderate risk, which is that level four. And I think the important ones that we should talk about are prescription drug management, and then a new one that was added in 2021, which is the diagnosis or treatment significantly limited by social determinants of health. And then I do want to talk a little bit about this issue around over-the-counter medications as well. But let's focus on that prescription drug management first. So, you know, what does that mean and what makes it, you know, moderate risk? So it's a lot about, you know, how are you managing your prescription drugs for your patient? Are you refilling those? Are you changing them? Are you starting new medications? Or are you discontinuing medications? And it's important, of course, to document if you're doing those things, and also perhaps what management decisions you're making around that. It may not be enough to just say continue current meds. It's always a better idea to document some of your decision making around that, like what labs are you managing or looking at, what are potential side effects you're considering. I think another important thing to know is that the CPT and AMA specifically defined that the decision not to start a medication is also considered prescription drug management. It's a little sentence that's stuck in there when they talk about medical decision making, where they say a decision to forego a treatment is also gets you to that level. And so, for instance, one example I use a lot here is when I'm discussing lipid management with patients and I review their cardiovascular risk based on the 10-year risk calculator. And they're in that middle section where they may not be specifically at a higher risk, but they're at a medium risk. And we're going through the pros and cons of starting that medication. And they may decide not to start the medicine or continue lifestyle management. And then we're going to check those lipids again in the future. Or even if they're higher risk, but make a decision that they don't want to start that particular medication. So if I document that I have that shared medical decision making with them and they opted not to start a prescription medication, that'll get me to moderate risk. even though I didn't actually start a medication, but we discussed it and made a decision not to start it. And just as a reminder, remember, risk is only one of the three elements that you need to meet to bill at a certain level. You always need two of the three. So you're going to have to, you know, if you're going to bill a level four for moderate risk, you also have to get there on either problems or data in order to bill at a level four.
Correct. Got it. Okay. So you were talking about the prescription drug management versus over-the-counter. And I know one question that we sometimes get from physicians as well as coders is, or what are the list of medications that counts for moderate risk? Is, you know, a statin always moderate risk? Give me the list of medications, which is level four, level three, but it's not always that straightforward. So can you expand on that?
Yeah, and it's really not. Sure, it would be nice if it were that way, but I don't think anybody, you know, our Medicare carriers or insurance, they're not going to give us a list. And really, it's about the individual patient, you know. And there are going to be times, honestly, where over-the-counter drugs may actually be moderate or even high risk in certain patients. So we may make a decision to recommend that a patient take a short course of nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories for an acute back injury or something like that. But they're an older patient who has maybe some stage 2 CKD, and we know that long-term NSAIDs are really going to be not a great idea for them. But we believe that a short course of some NSAIDs are maybe safe enough with some surveillance of their kidney function or other follow-up. And so in that case, you know, NSAIDs may actually be moderate risk as long as we are appropriately documenting the risk. In all of these cases, you, the individual physician, can say that something is moderate risk and why, or that something is high risk and why, based on your clinical judgment, knowing the patient, knowing their underlying diseases and the circumstances. So it's not a bright line all the time that prescription drugs are always only moderate risk. They might be high risk, or that over-the-counter drugs are always only low risk, because in certain scenarios, they may be moderate risk. And so it's all about your individual patient, how you document, and the individual circumstances. But if you want a list, man, it's just not going to happen.
Got it. Yep. That's very helpful. Okay. Now go ahead with your level five.
Yeah. So I think the challenge has always been, has seemed to me for the many years that I've been, you know, thinking about this and teaching it, is that there's really this chasm between level four and level five, meaning there are many things that get kind of pushed into the level four bucket. You know, there's the one acute illness or undiagnosed new problem. There's the two stable chronic illnesses, but there's also five stable chronic illnesses plus, you know, an acute illness. And you don't really get up to level five until you have this chronic illness with a severe exacerbation or a chronic illness or injury that poses threat to life. And so you're really stuck with a lot of patients at level four that have this sort of wide bell curve of presenting complaints. That being said, there are level five patients that present to internal medicine clinics and to all clinics. And generally, they're the people that probably should have gone to the emergency department, but instead they come chomping into your clinic, and you manage them in the clinic because they're the folks that, you know, aren't going to go to the emergency department or didn't realize they needed to, or they just have really complex problems. And they really want to try to stay at home and be managed, you know, outside of the hospital often. And so I think those are the patients. And, you know, the examples I use when I'm teaching our residents, for instance, are, you know, a COPD patient who's, you know, fairly brittle and doesn't want to be hospitalized. And there are often people who are going to follow up rapidly in clinic. And I think there are many probably specialty patients who are this way as well, who maybe could be hospitalized, but you're going to trial them at home, see how they do, and see them back quickly in clinic. So, you know, those are the level five patients in terms of their presenting problem. You know, the risk side is really about, I think for a lot of these patients, it's that decision around hospitalization. And so, you know, you may be saying to the patient or thinking and documenting, you know, this is someone who I could really be thinking about putting in the hospital. and I'm discussing that with the patient, but we're making a decision together that we're going to trial some therapy at home, and we're going to follow them up in, you know, 1 to 2 days with good safety parameters about when they should call or come back if they don't improve. And I think an important point we want to make here is that under that high risk for additional diagnostic testing, when it says decision regarding hospitalization or escalation of hospital level care, the decision not to hospitalize a patient counts here. And so having that discussion or saying this is someone who could be hospitalized, we're deciding not to, that counts there because you've documented your medical decision making around that.
What about the decision to send the patient to the ER?
So I think that's a tough one. I think, again, if you document, like, I think this patient's really sick and may require a higher level of care and hospitalization, but the only way for that to happen is for them to go to the emergency department, I think that you could bill that as a level 5. I think it depends on how much you do. And I think you and I have talked about this before, like, if you like look in the door at them and you're like respiratory distress, call EMS. Like, I don't know that you've done enough. You know what I mean? But if you like do some management, evaluate them, make the decision, I think it kind of depends on like how much you do personally, you know, and what is the mechanism for them to go from your clinic to the emergency department? You know, if you're out in a community clinic and they're going to be with you for 15 minutes while you're waiting on somebody to come, then that's one thing. If you're like at a, you know, at one of the clinics I worked at one academic center, literally like I could call transport to, you know, to get someone over and it could be done in like 5 minutes with, you know, one of the residents going with them. Like, I'm not sure I would have billed a level 5 for that when really what I was doing was sort of transferring care and really not doing much of an evaluation. But that's just my personal like thought about it.
That makes sense.
You have to think about like how much intervention did you do and what was your medical decision making? And
got it. So we've covered pretty much everything about the medical decision making in terms of level 3 versus 4 versus 5. Can you also just touch on the other component, which is time, billing based on time?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So I continue to be super excited about time-based billing on the outpatient side, primarily because of the big change that occurred, which was to allow all time on the data service instead of just face-to-face time. This is such a boon. It always made me angry that my inpatient colleagues could count all their data service time, including, you know, coordination of care and documentation time and all of that. And yet, for whatever reason, on the outpatient side, we could only count face-to-face time. So I think that was probably the most helpful change that was made, in my opinion. If you can do things like get your documentation done on the day of service, if you can do some of your prep work on the day of service, if you have a particularly complicated patients that end up taking more time than you expect for whatever reason, we have at my clinic a fairly good population of non-English speaking patients, which means we're using either in-person or telephone translators, which always add time to our visits. And so the ability to get some increased credit for those patients who take more time, even when it's unlikely that their complexity would get there on medical decision making, that allows a little bit of extra payment, whether it's RVU payment or reimbursement, direct reimbursement patient for those patients that are taking that extra time. And then if you have particularly complex patients where you're having to do a lot of communication with other physicians or other healthcare workers, then there's also a prolonged service time that can be added on top of the level 5 visit.
Okay. And can you just recap, what are the time cutoffs for both new and established E&M visits for the level 3, 4, and 5?
Yeah, of course. So for established patients, a level 3 is 20 minutes. Level 4 is 30 minutes. And a level 5 is 40 minutes. And for new patients, level 3 would be 30 minutes. level 4 is 45 minutes and a level 5 is 60 minutes or more.
Great. And then in terms of documenting the time, I think an important point is also you don't have to specifically say or break it down into what, you know, I spent this much time face-to-face and this much time on documentation, this much on chart review. It's just total time.
Total time. It can be discontinuous. It's, you just need to put the total time. And again, on the day of service. So if you prep the day before, I now prep the day before because I have morning clinics. And I just can't get up at 5 in the morning or 4:30 in the morning to spend, you know, an hour and a half prepping. So I don't get to count that time, but such as it is.
So I guess before we wrap up, any other practical tips or pearls of wisdom for physicians who want to become more efficient at documentation and more accurate at coding?
Yeah, I think it's not a bad idea to spend some time reading the coding rules, to look really carefully at the data elements. We didn't go over the data here, but you can look at it in more detail in the toolkit as well. I do think there are times where we're probably doing the work in the data section and we may not be thinking about how that could be increasing our going level at times. So when you have patients in whom you're reviewing a lot of data or you're discussing with an outside provider or something like that, you may actually be able to have an increase in your billing level related to the data. And so I do suggest that people spend a little bit of time looking at these to sort of understand them. I think when you do that, you end up, the billing becomes more intuitive and you're not sort of thinking about the specific widgets or pieces of it, but it becomes more intuitive over time because you've learned it and sort of have a handle on it a little bit more.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Engel. That was a really helpful discussion.
Wonderful.
And I really appreciate all your expertise and your insight over the years on this topic.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the AMA Steps Forward podcast series. AMA's Steps Forward program is open access and free to all at stepsforward.org. Steps Forward can help put the joy back into medicine by offering real-world solutions to the challenges that your practice is confronting today. We look forward to you joining us next time on the AMA's Steps Forward podcast series, stepsforward.org.